Thank you, Darren. I greet you all in the name of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. How fitting it is that our nation should have a set aside a holiday to celebrate the first Thanksgiving Day, as we call it. And how proper that we have a one holiday actually dedicated to our God. Have you thought about that? We only have one that's actually dedicated to our God, officially. And I don't want to say it too loud. Somebody might hear that and go to the court, but it's something that I really enjoy. And the story surrounding the pilgrims and Thanksgiving is just fascinating to me. So, because of that, you're going to get it. All that I could come up with. So I'm just giving a title to this. This might be a lecture rather than a sermon, but that's all right, because that's what the pilgrims did. Every Thursday, they gathered and had lecture. They called it that. It was not the Sunday service. It was not their worship. It was their lecture. And they were a people who were intelligent and liked to learn things. And the women were well-versed in learning as well, because they were expected to teach the children that they might be well-versed in learning. They weren't backward people. But to go on, Thanksgiving is a very old idea, and I am quoting here from Leviticus to show you what I mean. And here's what it says. And this is the law of the sacrifice of peace offerings, which he shall offer unto the Lord if he offer it for a thanksgiving. Then he shall offer with the sacrifice of thanksgiving unleavened cakes, mingled with oil, and unleavened wafers anointed with oil, and cakes mingled with oil of fine flour, fried. Do you ever think about having fried cakes for Thanksgiving? Besides the cakes, he shall offer for this offering leavened bread with the sacrifice of thanksgiving of his peace offerings. Leviticus 7, 11 to 13. So the old law also honored Thanksgiving in their way. A day of Thanksgiving was proclaimed by the Continental Congress in 1777. That would have been the first official proclamation by a governing body. However, the pilgrims had theirs, their Thanksgiving feast, in the fall of 1621, when William Bradford, the governor, invited local Indians to share in the bounty of harvest. You think of the pilgrims, you think of old people, don't you? Well, William Bradford reached the age of 30, finally, a couple of years after he became governor of Plymouth. They were young people, hardy people, and they knew what they wanted. At the request of Congress, George Washington proclaimed November 26, 1789, as the Day of Thanksgiving. But it was directed at Thanksgiving for the Constitution, which had been framed. And they were all enjoying the fact that they had that Constitution. But Abraham Lincoln declared a national Thanksgiving holiday in 1863. And then, capping it all off, in 1941, that's a pretty interesting year for it, isn't it? In 1941, President Franklin Roosevelt signed a bill officially establishing a Thanksgiving holiday in the United States for the fourth Thursday of November. And what happened the very next month? We were attacked by Japan and Hawaiian Islands and entered into World War II. Sometimes things happen in a very appropriate way. Well, let's learn some things along the way here, about the pilgrims. At the end of this, I'll give you my sources for these things. By the 1600s, the Puritans and their opposition to the bishops of the Anglican Church had grown so strong that King James was obliged to include them as partners with the Anglican scholars in the preparation of the authorized King James Bible. I have a copy of that with me right now. And it was quite an achievement. There were many, many scholars. But King James did a wonderful thing. In lining this up, he called in the Anglican scholars who supported the bishops, and he argued with them, taking the side of the Puritans. And when he got through, they believed that he probably would favor the Puritans and all the stuff they're going to do on this Bible. And then he called in the Puritans. He took the Anglican scholars' side and argued with them. And they left the meeting believing that he would side with the bishops and that they wouldn't have much to say about that. But they worked together and created the best English Bible ever produced. I'm glad that we call it our own. So these things happened before 1611 and prior to the pilgrims, as we call them. Some of the Puritans believed the Church of England had become secular and corrupt. Well, they probably were right, because power does corrupt. They formed a sect called Separatists. They were not called pilgrims until 1820, and I don't have any source as to when they were called that or what called them that, but that's the time. Which long after they came to New England. So they called themselves Separatists. They were Puritans, but they were Puritan Separatists. Different from the other Puritans, and they were agricultural people. So they left England because they didn't want their children to grow up in that atmosphere, and they went to Holland in 1608, thinking that they would be by themselves and not affected by anyone else. They could carry out their worship as they wanted. But what happened was their children mixed with the children of Holland. And they were worried about that, so they sought an opportunity to come to the Americas. In those days, there were companies that owned, not the land really, but owned rights for developing certain areas of New England. And one of them was, the very popular one, was the Virginia Company. The pilgrims tried to sign up with the Virginia Company. In fact, they did sign up with the Virginia Company to develop the northern part of the Virginia colony. And more about what happened with that later. From history.com, one of my sources, it said this: the Puritan migration was overwhelmingly a migration of families. The literacy rate was high, and the intensity of devotional life, as recorded in the many surviving diaries, sermon notes, poems, and letters, was seldom to be matched in American life. Does that change your attitude toward the pilgrims any? They were learned people. They also were brave people and adventurous, or they wouldn't have done what they did. But a migration of families, a very important point here. The other settlers who came, it was the men who came, the women stayed behind. There were very few women. There certainly were not many families. And those colonies did not thrive. The Virginia Company, which they would have been associated with had they gotten there, was that kind of thing. And there was always trouble. They didn't make a lasting mark on our country like the pilgrims did in Plymouth. From FamilySearch.org, another one of my sources, during the first winter, 45 of the 102 pilgrims died from diseases such as scurvy. Can you imagine this? The 102 of them came on the Mayflower, and in the first winter, 45 died. That's approaching half of them. The 50-something that were left, you can do the math, of the 50 so that were left, only 4 were adult females. Would you like to be one of those? Have all of the work of the women for the colony on your shoulders. But they got more colonists came in 1621. A boat called the Fortune brought 37 new settlers. What they neglected to do was bring enough extra provisions. And so there they were. They had very little to eat, and they suddenly got 37 more people. I put here that they were from Leiden. Leiden is the place in Holland where they had gone and spent some time. So they were still bringing some out of Holland and getting them over to Plymouth. By January of 1630, enough new settlers had arrived to bring the population of the colony up to a whopping 300. And by that time, they were prosperous. They had weathered the storms and were doing well. Well, I think the most fascinating story to me is the story of Squanto. Not really his name, just the name that was given to him. And so it stuck, and we always call him Squanto. But this man, he lived 37 years, and he accomplished more things than I can imagine. And he was a world traveler in a day when it was hard to be a world traveler. So his name, Tisquantum, born November 15th, 1585, of the Patuxet tribe in the Wampanoag Confederacy. The Wampanoag Confederacy would have been different tribes of Indians that worked together. They were the first to contact the Pilgrims, and it wasn't Squanto that contacted them first. You might have heard, but he died at the age of 37, and maybe more about that later. And now follow this remarkable life. I just can't imagine being in the position he was in his day when you traveled by sailing vessel. In 1605, he was captured, along with others. There were others of his tribe, by Fernando Gorges, who owned the Plymouth colony. By that, I mean he had owned the rights to that colony for colonization for a period of time. I'm not sure that he still owned it when they went there. But he captured these young Indians and took them to England. Was he going to make slaves out of them? No. He had better plans than that. He taught them to be guides and interpreters. And among them was Squanto. He learned English and how to be a guide and an interpreter. He returned to New England with John Smith, but was abducted by Thomas Hunt, one of Smith's officers, to be sold with others as slaves in Spain, along with produce from New England. So this guy, Thomas Hunt, he gathered up the produce, and he gathered up some young Indians, including Squanto, and he headed for Spain. And he was going to sell them as slaves. Well, what happened? Our story might have ended there. Squanto may have been a servant in somebody's house in Spain, have to learn another language. But no, some local friars discovered the slavery plot and took those that had not yet been sold, including Squanto, to instruct them in the Catholic faith. So he was taken then by the friars to a monastery, I suppose that's where they were, and was being taught the Catholic beliefs. Another amazing turn of events. Squanto himself was able to convince the friars to let him try to return home to New England by way of England. How he got to England from Spain, I have no idea. I was not able to find anything all about that, but they believed his story, and he did go back to England. So back in England, Squanto lived and worked with John Sweeney, a London shipbuilder, for several years. So he learned the shipbuilding trade. Isn't this amazing? And he's quite young in this. He's 20-something, and he's learned English now. He probably learned some Spanish, and And he traveled from Spain to England, and now he's working with a shipbuilder. Well, John Slaney took him to Cooper's Cove, Newfoundland, in 1617. Now, he was a shipbuilder, and he also had ships. So he brought him along on his trip to Newfoundland. So he's too far north to get to Plymouth very easily, and I have no idea what all he was doing or what he was supposed to do with John Slaney, but he was sent back to England by Thomas Derman in 1618, the next year, but returned to England with John Smith's ship in 1619, back and forth across the Atlantic Ocean on a sailing vessel. And he joined an exploratory expedition along the coast with Captain Derman. Now, Captain Derman knew what he needed. He needed an interpreter and someone familiar with the coast. And so he got Squanto, because he probably was the most learned leader for the expedition that he could find by that time, and doing quite well. But while with the expedition, he discovered that all of his village had died of a plague. There was nobody left. There was not a trace of the village. Can you imagine going there after a few years, expecting to be reunited with your friends and your relatives, and nothing's there? And when you inquire, you find out they all died of the plague. It probably was smallpox that was circulating among the Indians at that time, and it caused a lot of death. On March 22nd, 1621, Squanto was introduced to the pilgrim leaders by Samoset, who had earlier contact with them. Samoset was from the Confederation, and he ended up leaving Squanto with them to help them, and he was a great help to them. So he helped the colonists to recover from the harsh first winter. See, they had just had the first winter. They had lost all those people to disease. They were trying to make a go of it. And he instructed them how to raise the corn and how to catch the fish they needed, including the ones they put with the planting of corn for fertilizer, and finding local wildlife for food. So let's go back to the colony now and what they were doing. I find this fascinating too, just the things that went on. The Mayflower was blown off course by storms, landing far north of its original destination. So they never got to Virginia Company at all. Thus, they were no longer under the rules of, and Virginia Company there, and I didn't do it, the rules of the Virginia Company, and decided to make a new statement by which to govern their colony. It was called the Mayflower Compact. I have that in the next slide. This is an amazing part of the story, and I think God directed, like many of the things I've already told you, God directed all of this. If they had gone to the Virginia Company like they intended, they would have been under those rules. Those rules allowed for a few preachers to come and preach to the people. But there was not any religious freedom there. They were able, because they missed that, they were able to write their own compact and decide what they were going to do. And it made possible. This colony was peopled by families and family-oriented and had a strong religious belief and wanted people to be free. The freedom was not immediate. I'll show you how that occurred as well. Those who had sponsored their relocation to New England expected the pilgrims to live communally. Thus, there was to be no private land or property ownership. This was called common course and condition. So they were under common course and condition. Would you like to live that way? You didn't own your home. You didn't own your land. You worked with others for the common good to produce the food. Sounds like it could be nice. By 1623, Governor Bradford had determined that the colony could not survive under common course and condition. They could not meet the demands of their investors in England. In other words, they were going to go broke. So families were given plots of land to farm, and later privately owned cattle and homes. That saved the colony. So I just make one brief quote from Bradford's journal. He said, "It was a very good success." He said more than that, but that I thought was the salient point, a very good success. Now let's think about that. They could have lived communally, but they weren't surviving that way. They couldn't make their payments. They couldn't make enough food for the colony. But when they were given their own plot and their own home and their own cattle, they thrived. And they were able to send produce to other lands. And they were able to make their payments. And the colony was very successful. So what was the Mayflower Compact? I've left off the prologue, and this is the body of the compact, written in a language that they had to write official documents in. Having undertaken for the glory of God, that's their purpose, for the glory of God and advancement of the Christian faith in honor of our king and country, I think probably in that order, the king and country was last, a voyage to plant the first colony in Northern Virginia. Do by these present solemnly and mutually in the presence of God and one another, covenant and combine ourselves together into a civil body public, for our better ordering and preservation and furtherance of the ends aforesaid. So what were they going to further? They were there to further the advancement of the Christian faith and for the glory of God. They were doing these things. And by virtue hereof to enact, constitute, and frame such just and equal laws, ordinances, acts, constitutions, and offices from time to time as shall be thought most meet and convenient for the general good of the colony, unto which we promise all due submission and obedience. Wouldn't it be great if the people who lead our country would promise all due submission and obedience to the laws that they make for us? In witness whereof, we have hereunder subscribed our names at Cape Cod, the 11th of November, in the year of the reign of our sovereign Lord King James. And then he was the king of various other things that were listed. But anyhow, it was in 1620. They did this while on board the Mayflower, before the colony was built. In fact, all of the next winter, the people who could work at building buildings went ashore. The others stayed on the Mayflower until, I believe it was the end of January. And they had to deal with sickness and death. And so I asked the question, what can we learn from this history? What would we have done? You know, what would I have been like if I'd been with them? Seeing people dropping like flies from this, what you could not understand, and to seeing that there were just not any promises of good things yet. A harsh winter, no way to deal with it, and it wouldn't be much of a glorious outlook, would it? But these people not only survived this, but they did it with the gumption to make a new kind of living for the people. So I have to say, we have to first say that God takes charge of events according to his purposes. We don't know what those purposes are ahead of time, and it always seems to take too much time to accomplish what we think he is going to accomplish. In their case, time was going by and people were dying, and work was not getting done. And yet, they continued to believe that God was in charge. Could I do that? Could you do that? I don't know. The Mayflower being blown off course made it possible for a colony to be established with a new set of rules making way for people to seek religious freedom in America. That's where religious freedom actually began in the United States or America. The other colonies didn't have it, and they would not have promoted it. But these people, these families, did. And we owe that to them. The remarkable events in the life of Tisquantum saved him from the plague. See, he would have been in his village. He would have died of the plague too. And brought him to the colonists exactly when they needed what he could offer. His good command of the English language, his knowledge of how to survive in the local climate. He was only with them about a year. And then the Confederation assigned him to another assignment, and they put somebody in charge of him. And he died while on that assignment further north in what would be Massachusetts, part of Massachusetts today. And he died of what they said was the plague. But there has always been suspicion that he was poisoned by the guy that was put in charge of him because he was jealous of his abilities and his good relationship with the colonists. Do you realize that there was never a war with the Indians during that time? There was cooperation. And that was another achievement of the colony that was not necessarily achieved by other colonies. They were able to create a climate in which there was a good relationship with the Indians. The results of giving families responsibility over their own prosperity, or property rather, personal wealth and applied effort. This is something we can learn from this history, that there was an experiment in communal living and it failed. But what did succeed was private enterprise. It's when the people had choices, when they felt responsible for what they were doing, and nobody could shirk that responsibility. If we can apply that to whole countries that we've seen come and go since the pilgrims were in this place in Plymouth. I pulled something out of Proverbs to kind of underline the experience they had. I went by the field of the slothful and by the vineyard of the man void of understanding. And lo, it was all grown over with thorns. There was more there after that, all bad things. Then I saw and considered it well. I looked upon it and received instruction. I don't know if Governor Bradford knew this verse, but I think that's what he did. He looked at what was going on and he received instruction and passed it on at the age of 30 to the members of the colony that he ruled over. How many people here are 30 years old? Are there anyone here 30 years old? Yeah. Could you imagine being in his place? All of that that went on, and you were in charge of it. You had to decide what could be done. With God's help, severe hardship can be a stepping stone to great achievement. Another thing that they taught us, right? Do you believe that? Do you look at your own life and see hardships that have come before you? And what if they were severe hardships? Life-threatening hardships. Could you see any chance of those things being a stepping stone to great achievement? Well, they did. Probably as a collective of minds, who considering the situation they were in, what will we do? And looking into the scriptures, as they always did, and attending lecture day, they were able to come up with a system that worked. The benefits of Thanksgiving are linked with two things in the scripture, and I wanted to enumerate those with you by these scriptures. One is a link with prayer. For all things are for your sakes, that the abundant grace might through the thanksgiving of many redound to the glory of God, from 2 Corinthians 4, verse 15. Look at this, what Paul wrote. Sometimes he writes things that are kind of hard to put together, but through the thanksgiving of many, we have a day called Thanksgiving. Supposedly, everybody is expressing their thanksgiving and praying to God on that day. I suppose some don't. But will that redound to the glory of God? I believe it will. And if we celebrate our Thanksgiving prayerfully, if we remember how he has been a provider for us, then the glory of God will redound, not just around us, but in our own personal lives and in our families. That's why we have this holiday. Worship God, from Alma 16, 237, 238. Worship God in whatsoever place you may be in. Do you do that? In spirit and in truth, that ye live in thanksgiving daily for the many mercies and blessings which he doth bestow upon you. Yea, and I also exhort you, my brethren, that ye be watchful unto prayer continually, that ye may not be led away by the temptation of the devil, that he may not overpower you, that ye may not become his subjects at the last day. For behold, he rewardeth you no good thing. That's quite true. I'd like what was pointed out to me not too long ago, that the devil really has no power except what we give him in our own minds and by our own behavior. And so being prayerful with our thanksgiving is vital to all of us. Continue in prayer and watch in the same with thanksgiving, Colossians 4:2. There's another thing associated with thanksgiving, and thank you to the young people who came up here this morning, because they underlined my point. Thanksgiving and song go together. There are lots of scriptures on this, but I'll cite a few of them. It's only a few of them. For the Lord shall comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places, and he will make her wilderness like Eden, and her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness shall be found therein, thanksgiving and the voice of melody. 2 Nephi 5, 72, 74. And this one is from Psalm 95. Oh, come, let us sing unto the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before his presence with thanksgiving and make a joyful noise unto him with psalms. For the Lord is a great God and great King above all gods. He has been our providence from the forming of our nation. The founding fathers used that term, providence. That recognizing this, what is said in the psalm, that he is great King above all gods, and he provides for us. We should be in his presence with thanksgiving. Great is our Lord, and great power. His understanding is infinite. The Lord lifteth up the meek. He casteth the wicked down to the ground. Sing unto the Lord with thanksgiving. Sing praise upon the harp unto our God. Psalm 147, 5 through 7. His understanding is infinite. And he will lift up the meek, those who are willing to not make themselves grand, who are willing to be humble, he will lift them up. And it's sometimes hard to understand that we don't have to promote ourselves if we are meek, if we're thinking of the Lord, if we're praying unto him, if we're regarding him as our providence, he will lift us up, just as he did the people in that colony in Plymouth when they came to him, when they trusted in him. He lifted them up. And yes, we should sing praise unto our God. I don't know how many harps we have around here, but I think we get the point. So that's my celebration of Thanksgiving with you. I hope that you learned something you didn't know before, and that you will, on Thanksgiving Day, go prayerfully to him and thank him for these lessons that he has sent down to us through time. Those are my sources from the internet. You might check some of those out yourself sometime. Thank you.
We have a lot to be thankful for.